sponsors.
Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe in Hanalei is proud to support KKCR and its Ohana, offering organic groceries and produce, a cafe featuring fresh salad bar, hot meals and soups, fresh-made smoothies, and baked goods. Located in the heart of Hanalei, Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe, 826-0089.
Kauai Marine and Mower, located in Old Kapa'a Town, is proud to underwrite this KKCR program. Kauai Marine and Mower features Honda garden and lawn equipment and also Echo power equipment. 823-0556.
Anahola Stringed Instruments is proud to support KKCR. Mickey Sussman has been building Island Koa guitars, ukulele, and violins on Kauai since 1972. Time-honored designs and special orders. Prompt and complete restoration, repair, and reforestation. AnaholaStringedInstruments.com or 822-1645.
Aya's Garden, all-natural garden and greenhouse supply. In Kapa'a, down Kukui Street from the Dragon Building. Fertilizers, amendments, soil, seeds, garden and farm organic growing supplies. Open Monday through Saturday. More information at 822-7333 or visit Aya's Garden on Facebook.
Thank you so much to our underwriters for keeping us on the air here at Kauai Community Radio. And we're back once again for another episode of In the Garden on the Farm, a celebration of life in the garden and life on the farm here on the beautiful island of Kauai and through the Hawaiian Islands and around the world. Hey, Robin.
Hey, and what a delicious life it is.
Truly, truly. We love to dine on the delectable treats from this land and share them widely, and we had a special treat today that maybe you could give thanks to the person who gifted us the acai.
Oh, sure. Thanks again to Tambor Acai. We enjoyed an incredible smoothie with that raw. They have a new raw unsweetened acai pulp that's frozen, and it was absolutely delicious, guys. Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm. That's the fruit from an edible palm from South America, and thanks to those folks for setting us up with some of that fresh palm berry juice, if you will. And we are celebrating the palm family on the show this week. We're getting around to some great techniques and some great insight on coconut culture this week and next week. Right now we're going to start off with the celestial session as we do, turning to the heavens for inspiration on planting and other activities for the garden or farm. Today's moon phase is brought to you by the 2014 Ke Ala Oka Mahina calendar. It's a publication of Hui Mauli Ola and Kamehameha schools. And today's Hawaiian moon phase is Hua. This is in the Poi Poi or full roundness and fulling on Ahulu, the second week in the 3 weeks of the Hawaiian moon phase. And Hua will rise on Kauai today at 4:56 p.m. this afternoon, reach her transit or highest point in the sky at 10:37 p.m. tonight, and she'll set at 4:17 a.m. Thursday. That's tomorrow. 91% of the moon's beautiful face is illuminated, which we will see when those clouds part above our heads from time to time, depending on where we may be found on the island. We have the full moon coming up this Saturday morning at 1:25 a.m. And in the Hawaiian tradition, these are all great nights for planting. The mana'o on Hua. Hua means fruit, tuber, egg, produce, yield, ovum, seed, grain, offspring. And it also means meat, as in an opi'i shell or a alamihi crab. It means to bear fruit, tuber, or seed, to bear a child or fruitful. So a very meaningful word for us gardeners. And the planting recommendations, uala, sweet potato, ipo, the gourd, and fruiting plants. Fishing is also said to be good on this moon, and this moon also gave its name to our new tool shed at the Kalihiwai Food Forest, thanks to a Roshan who dubbed she christened the shed the Hua Shack.
Nice.
And so just in honor of all the fruit that is coming out of the food forest as well as will in the future.
May it be for all of us.
Indeed.
Well, in the biodynamic look at things, today and tomorrow the moon is residing in Scorpio, which is a water sign, making it a good time to work with our leaf plants. We will be leaving the planting time here over the weekend, so today and tomorrow, good time to plant some summer greens like bok choy, pak choy. Those Asian greens do so well in the heat. Things like Malabar spinach, which we talked about last week on the show. So great day to get our watery, juicy, leafy plants in the ground. Friday and Saturday, the moon will be in Sagittarius, a fire sign, making it a good time to work with our fruiting plants. And if you look at the Hawaiian moon calendar, it sounds like certainly a great time, Friday at least, to be planting some fruiting plants in the ground. And then as we enter the ascending moon and the sap of the plants, the energies of the plants rises, we can look at things like pruning, grafting, and air layers. According to the biodynamic calendar, Sunday is not a productive day for planting, so we can take a day off, perhaps, or do some of those other chores that need to be done. Monday, the moon will be in Capricorn, an earth sign, making it a decent time to work with our root plants. And I'm noticing my taro patch now that things are drying out just a little bit in my neighborhood. I could probably go out there and trim off some of the browning leaves off of the plant without damaging the plant too much. That's something I plan to do on that root day. And Tuesday next, the moon will be in Aquarius, an air sign. That makes us a good time to work with our flowering plants. And it's been my practice to do my vegetative propagation on those flower days and the ascending moon. I seem to have the most luck with rooting things around those times.
Yeah. Beautiful advices from the celestial realms. Thank you, Robin, for that insight.
Sure. And there's so much more to biodynamics. And as the show progresses here, and we mentioned in the introduction that we'll be talking about cow manure, and there are so many spiritual significances in biodynamics to the cow herself. A lot of cosmic energy there, and it's a subject that's pretty close to my heart, but we'll have to talk more about that later.
Yes, we shall. And for now, we're going to go to notable news, topics that affect us in the gardening and farming realm, things we want to consider, scientific research, or other things that occur out there in the world. And you cropped one up, Robin, that is specific to our discussion as well on cow manure.
That's right. That's right. In Science Daily, their website is sciencedaily.com if you want to read the article in full. A new study has found that manure from dairy cows that live in factory farm systems is found to have a surprising number of unique, previously unidentified antibiotic resistance genes. So basically, this is a result of too many antibiotics used to treat animals in the feed of animals that are forced to live in such close confinement with each other that sicknesses spread really, really fast. So almost as a matter of course, without even having a problem, the antibiotics are just given to them to prevent any of these. And basically, how this affects us is that factory farms do supply some of their manure to farmers, and when this manure gets spread out onto the field, and the bacteria that live in the soil can pull up those antibiotic resistance genes, that's just one step closer to it landing in the food itself, which is then lands on our plate.
That's right. Farmers using raw or composted cow manure on vegetable crops could lead to a scenario where residual manure bacteria might cling to produce, and they or their genes might move to the human ecosystem, according to the article. And it speaks as well about the transfer of genes through horizontal gene transfer. So sometimes the genes from one of these altered bacteria can actually share its genes with another bacteria. And so there's all different kinds of ways that these antibiotic resistant genes can get into our food supply. We do depend on so many of these bacteria for a healthy gut ecosystem, and yet this is something that nature didn't intend, and we've created this imbalance, and nature, of course, finding the way to balance by perhaps limiting our population.
Sure. And, you know, not to overlook the reality that those of us who are not vegetarians and do partake in eating meats, that guaranteed those antibiotic resistance genes are in the actual cows as well, animals that wind up on our dinner plate also. So it's not just the long way round through the manure on the fields that these things can find their way onto our dinner plate. Sometimes it can be direct. So we want to be really choosy and, in my opinion, careful not to, in my humble opinion, not to eat industrial meat. And let's find local sources. We have a couple great ranches here on Kauai, and it's due time we start giving them our business.
Truly. And as we look at doing large-scale dairy operations on the island, this is another one of the considerations, is there's a lot of different products that are going to happen, and this is certainly a very significant byproduct that could be a real windfall to many of the farmers around the island to have access to cow manure. However, if it is laden with the antibiotics themselves, or now these antibiotic resistant genes, it could be more of a liability than a benefit to have that kind of thing being produced on the island. So
no
doubt, whatever way we can make better choices about how we're raising our animals and the products that result from them, let's decide as a community to do that.
Absolutely. You know, I think lots of cows at a sensitive area like Mahalapu is questionable in and of itself, but it seems like we have an opportunity that we could really make it something good, and I'm hoping that some right choices are made, because the product stream that could come from that could be so beneficial to our agricultural systems were it handled properly.
Yes, indeed. This is In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts Paul and Robin. And in this hour, we're going to be speaking with an esteemed coconut breeder, David Lobo, as well as our good friend John Parziali, more about cow dung. We know that's one of his favorite topics. But first, we are going to take another visit over to the farmer's market and look at one of the real gems of the season that's on the tables right now.
Indeed. Farmer's market's so fun. There's so much bounty there. Right now, I'd like to talk about pineapple. July is pineapple's natural season. And so be wary of pineapples that you find in other seasons, as often they have been forced to flower by either ethylene gas or a cocktail of hormones that tricks the bromeliads into flowering at a time of year besides July. And so July, here we are, and pineapple is here. The plant is actually indigenous to Paraguay in South America, and a lot like tomatoes, it was carried to the rest of the world by sailors all over the planet and made its way quite a long way. In the old days, the pineapple was a symbol of hospitality. And so even to this day, it just seems like such a nice gift when you go visit someone to bring them a nice pineapple. It really does have a feeling of hospitality to it. At any rate, well-grown papayas are high in high vitamin C, vitamin A, beta carotene. They have B vitamins, minerals like copper, manganese, and potassium. But what's most unique about pineapple is its enzyme called bromelain. Bromelain, considered the singer's enzyme, it has a powerful action on the throat. And I know quite a few singers who make it a point to eat a few slices of pineapple before they go and open up their lungs to light people up. But besides its powerful action on our vocal cords, it's also anti-inflammatory. Studies have been done to see it has anti-cancerous effects. It also fights arthritis, indigestion, and is formidable for intestinal parasites. So this is really good reasons to be partaking in these fresh pineapples that are at the market right now. And if you are at market and you're looking at pineapples and you're wondering, most of the time when the fruit is ripe, the outside's going to be either yellow or a paler yellow if it's a white sugarloaf pineapple inside, a darker yellow if it's a darker yellow fleshed fruit. But one of the best ways I've found is to pick it up and smell the bottom, the stem end. And what you want to smell is that perfume, that pineapple perfume. I think you might know what I'm talking about, the same way a mango seems to emanate a mango perfume. So follow your nose and pick one that's just your right size for you and your family. I'd like to let you know that they're chill sensitive, so you don't necessarily want to put a whole pineapple in the refrigerator. It can get a chill bruise on it, and so it's better actually to cut it up and then containerize it and refrigerate it instead of putting it in there whole. You also want to look for ones without blemishes or scratches or moldy spots, unless they're in the ding bin, which sometimes the farmers, if they've got a lot of pineapples, they will have some on special because they do have a small blemish, which is always a good way to get them. This is the time of year when I like to stock up on said pineapples and put them in the freezer, dehydrate them, and I'd like to share one of my favorite ways to use pineapple, if you don't mind.
Not a bit.
And I got into green smoothies a couple years ago, something that's really yummy, easy to make. If you have a garden, you have some greens, maybe too many greens, it's a lot. It's a good way to get a pile of them into your body without feeling like a rabbit. So my favorite green smoothie of all time is fresh pineapple, fresh banana, and kale leaves. And it is just so delicious. A few ice cubes. Mm. Really, really nutritious. It's power food.
Yeah. I was lucky enough to be over at your house maybe 10 days ago or so, and we were planning out the rest of the year's shows, and we dined on one of your homegrown pineapples, and I remember we were talking, should this feature be in Fresh Picked or should it be in Kitchen Garden, because you indeed have them in your kitchen garden. But you were kindly saying, hey, there's going to be a lot of great ones at the farmer's market. Let's make sure we let the listeners know that they should get out. A good reason to get out of the house is get down to that farmer's market and find the beautiful pineapples that are currently available.
Yeah, it sure is a delicacy of this season when they're fresh like this and not to be missed.
Yum, yum. Sounds really good. Well, moving on from pineapples to another one of our favorites, we are going to cover the coconut, and we're getting into good growing of coconuts. And before we're joined by our special guest on over the telephone, Robin's going to drop into a brief description on a good way to plant your coconut tree.
Yes, coconuts and other palms. I just want to give a quick little primer. If you're planning on planting any palms, or perhaps if you got all excited listening to us talk about acai and you might want to have one of those in your yard, or any other palm really, I just want to give a brief description of a good planting method for palm trees. And for starters, you don't want to be skimpy on the hole. Really dig a hole that's at least 6 inches wider and 6 inches deeper than the root ball of the plant in question. So if that amounts to you just have a coconut sprout, you'd still want to go ahead and give them. If you pack a plant in a really tight hole, it doesn't really have much of anywhere to go with without some food around it. So for starters, you know, get out your shovel and dig a nice big hole, and remember, you really only get to do this part one time, so it pays off to do it well.
Right.
In the hole, you'd like basically at a rate of about 1 to 3 organic compost to your native soil. Now, that's not a huge amount of native organic compost, and basically that's because you don't want to over amend the hole, because the palm roots, once they get to the edge and they notice that the native soil is so much less nutritious, sometimes they don't want to leave the cushy hole that you've given it, and they can actually get trapped in there. So you don't necessarily want to over amend the soil inside the hole either. Palm fertilizer, you would use something like 3:1:3 for an NPK ratio, and I do know that palms enjoy calcium as an extra supplement as well.
And will definitely show a deficit in it as well in their growth.
That's right. That's right. So here you have the opportunity. You dig a big hole. You add some organic compost, but not too much. And then you add some palm fertilizer, although not too much. We want to encourage the palm to grow well and then start fertilizing it outside the hole as well to encourage those roots to move deeper into the natural soil. When you actually put the palm tree in the hole, you want to water it very deeply while it's in there. When you first put it in there, get the palm nice and wet, and then also using water to flush out any air gaps as you're backfilling the soil back into air gaps are really no bueno in planting trees. So we want to basically...
They lead to root rot. Is that the problem there with the air gaps?
Air gaps. You know, I mean, some air in the soil we've learned is good. I wouldn't say that it's rot. I think it's more like drying, like it'll wick water away from the root ball later.
Okay.
So once we've watered it in deeply, now also a lot of question about how high or low or at what level to plant the palm tree. And basically, we want to have it just level with the soil the way it was in the pot, level. So the height of the root ball in the hole is very, very important, and you don't want to bury the trunk of a palm tree, otherwise known as planting it too low, because soil touching the bottom of the trunk can end up rotting the trunk, and you can lose your plant that way. And also, don't want to plant it too high, although there are stilt palms and palms that like to have some aerial roots going on, but pretty much you want it to be perfectly level. And once you're all finished with that part, it is wise to mulch your planting to hold in moisture, and as the mulch breaks down, it will provide some organic material for the natural earthworms that hopefully you have already happening in your soil. But when you mulch, you want to pay attention and keep the mulching material at least 6 inches away from the trunk of the tree. Again, so that spot that I call the magic line on a palm tree doesn't want to be underground, doesn't want to be too far above ground. It wants to be right at that magic spot. So there you have it. There's a quick primer on planting a palm tree.
Robin, thank you so much. Right now we are joined by our special guest, David Lobo of DJ Farms. David was born and raised in Mumbai, India in 1943. In the 1970s and 80s, he established and operated a major poultry hatchery that produced 100,000 chicks per day for the farmers of South India. In 1983, David began a hybrid coconut breeding program, and in the 30 years since then, over 2 million hybrid palms have been produced and outplanted in India from his stock of 23,000 mother palms located at his farm in southern India. His hybrids produce in one-third the time and yield 3 times the number of nuts per palm per year as compared with standard commercial varieties. All this supports David's vision of helping to bring Indian farmers out of poverty and achieve success. David joins us on the phone from Honolulu. David, it is indeed an honor to have you on the show today.
Well, it's my pleasure, too.
Thank you so much. First off, what brought you to Hawaii?
Well, we have a family get-together, and we decided on Hawaii this year. I have four of my children here with their children, so it's great fun.
Lovely. And I understand that you're going to be joining us on Kauai for just a very short visit to visit Philip Young's operation.
That's right, on Friday.
Very exciting. So I was hoping that we could just start out our discussion with a real general question. If you could tell us how important and why is the coconut so important in India?
In fact, a state in India called Kerala is named after a coconut tree. Kera means coconut. This tree really does a tremendous amount for the people. It gives a regular income every month. The farmer depends on it for sustainability. And mostly it's small farmers who rely on the coconut tree. 93% of the world's coconut farmers are small farmers. So in India, they get a lot of products from it. These certain states along the coastline in India have coconut oil and coconut as the base in their cooking. So it's very much part of daily life. Coconut oil is used for hair and oil and massages. So there are lots of uses. Every part of the coconut tree is used in India.
And of course, it's so important here in Polynesia as well. So great that we share that passion and just that essential connection with the coconut palm.
Right.
So in reading your website and other correspondence that we had, you spoke about the importance of the genesis of your breeding program under collaboration with United Nations sustainable farming expert Professor Anthony Davis. And I was wondering how, if you could briefly tell us about that collaboration.
Well, he was visiting India in 1982. A friend told me about him, that he's a coconut expert. I believe in our poultry farm, we should not leave any land uncultivated. I had 100 coconut trees planted in every spare area. I called him to visit it and see and give us advice. I showed him our garden with hybrid seeds. At the end, ended up by saying there are no hybrids there, maybe 15% only. And so I was very disappointed. And he said, why didn't you start hybrid farming? I said, it takes too long. So he said, yes, it does take too long, but your poultry will support it, so please go ahead and start it, because the farmers will get a very great advantage. The problem is that the gestation period for a coconut breeding project is very, very long. He said it'd take at least 10 years. It took us 22 years, actually, wow. But that was because we had negative factors about the water conditions and the resources were short and so on. So the long gestation period blocks most people from getting into coconut farming. We are fortunate we went into it. We started producing a few seedlings, and now we have over 2 million yielding in the field. We have a lot of feedback from them. We are producing about 500,000 a year now, and we hope to increase that to 1 million. Maybe I can go up to 2 million if I can get enough land in India. That is the problem.
Well, wow. It's staggering the scale at which you're doing your work.
It is, truly. Now, I understand, David, that coconuts are an outbreeding plant, so there's crossing that does happen out there in nature. Is that true in your experience?
By outbreeding, you mean intercropping? Is that what you mean?
No, I mean cross-pollinating.
Okay. In nature, you have... May I take a little trouble and go into the technical element? There are two kinds of palms, the dwarf and the tall. The dwarf tend to self-pollinate. The tall do not self-pollinate and cannot self-pollinate because the male flowers ripen and mature and die before the female flowers become mature.
Mm.
So necessarily they have to be pollinated by pollen from some other. So in hybridization, we hybridize the dwarf and tall. So we have to emasculate, remove every male flower, and then bring in the pollen and pollinate by hand again all the female buttons which are there.
Wow.
So if you produce a hybrid which is known for its productivity, it really helps the farmers. Did I answer your question? I'm sorry if I did.
Yes, you did, actually. And I've read that the male pollen can be kept refrigerated and keeps for quite a while. And let me just ask you, is that literally a by-hand process that your farmers in India go flower to flower?
No, nobody does that. We and a few other breeders will do this, where we go and collect the male flowers, process them, store the pollen in as proper conditions as we can, and use it whenever required, reconstitute and use it.
Wow.
Fantastic. So just to let our listeners know, we're speaking with David Lobo. He's a coconut breeder from southern India who's been working over 30 years to produce tremendously high-yielding hybrid coconut trees. And I was interested to see on your website as well that you're actually, for your hybrids, you're crossing, if I understood correctly, a dwarf with a tall?
That is correct. The dwarf is the mother and the tall is the father. We have developed our own dwarf. It's today called the DJ dwarf. It's under patenting. We've synthesize this new dwarf farm. Hmm.
So it is under some circumstances beneficial for farmers to grow the talls, even though it's difficult to harvest the fruit, or are people pretty much going straight toward dwarf varieties?
The dwarf variety is not a very good commercial variety. However, it is good for tender coconut water. You get a large quantity of water and sweeter. The big count in a dwarf may be 6 or 7 compared to a tall, which is 3, sometimes 4. Right. So that's the sugar level. Now, when we hybridize the two, we find our hybrid is around 6 to 7 in the hybrid as well. So the tender coconut water is sweeter, but also the nuts are larger and the number are more. To quantify that, each of our coconuts, our hybrid coconuts, gives a minimum of 0.5 liter of water. And we have a variety called the Pushkala, which gives between 700-800, almost a liter of water, 700-800 ml of water, almost a liter sometimes.
Wow. Coconut water has just exploded in its popularity in the U.S. Over the past, I'd say, 4 years or something like that. Is that true worldwide as well?
Absolutely true. I wouldn't say worldwide, because in the coconut growing areas, coconut water has always been drought. But in the temperate zones, Europe and the U.S., it's building up dramatically. I've been in touch with Coca-Cola, Vita Coco, Pepsi. They want large quantities. They're not able to get enough for their requirements. So there is a huge and growing market.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that really impressed me about your website and was really notable was how you are always thinking about the farmer and the integrity with which you make sure that you don't consider the transaction of you selling a tree is complete until they get their product, until it's really showing that it's being highly productive. So I would imagine that extension, or your advising to the farmers about how to take care of the trees, is probably a pretty important part of that relationship.
You're absolutely right. We have two, catchphrases in our company. One is, the purpose of business is profit through service. In fact, in our mission statement, it says, our profit is and must be the legitimate reward for services rendered to society. And the second one is, a sale is not complete until the farmer receives the anticipated benefits. And my people say, but the benefits will come over 50 years. I say, no, just 3 years, help the farmer, look after his plants well. In the third year, he should be making money, he should be doing well. And after that, you don't have to worry, because then the tree will look after the farmer. And that's what's happening. Our farmers are delighted, they are minting money, and we have some dramatically successful cases where May I share this story? It really, it makes me feel really good, so maybe that's why I'm sharing
Please.
It. But I'd like to.
Please.
This is a gentleman who is now the biggest industrialist in a town called Polati, a small town in Tamil Nadu, South India. And he asked me to visit. I visited him. I saw his gardens, and he said, "Sir, do you remember when you met me first?" And I said, "I'm so sorry, I don't." And he said, "I came in 1997 to your farm on a cycle. I was delivering insecticide to your garden. I was a delivery boy, and I saw your people talking about the hybrid, and I told my father, let's plant our 4 acres to hybrid, and he said there was no looking back. I keep on buying land. My group now has 400 acres. They earn around $2 million a year in profit from their 400 acres. But he's also become the largest industrialist, and he stood for elections, and now he's just become a member of parliament in the month of May. So I'm quite delighted."
Sorry.
Hello?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, it's wonderful when our good works come back and remind us of,
yes.
of the good work that we've done.
Yes.
And I'm sure you have many farmers who hold you in high regard for these, for really, you know, on a farm when you have a highly productive plant or part of your system, you just cherish it so much. So being a plant breeder really is a wonderful way to get the good karma, I would imagine. And we're interested as well. So we have coconuts here, and we're often trying to determine whether or not we've got a good coconut from its earliest stages of post-germination, and we're beginning to see the leaves come out. And I'm wondering if you can give us some good advice on how we might assess the quality of a coconut tree in its very youngest stage before we dig that big hole and make that commitment. If we're not able to get your hybrid coconuts here in Hawaii, how we might assess any given seedling.
I hope this doesn't sound like I'm being a little pompous, but we keep the records of all our trees, and we have computerized records of their monthly growth from the time they were planted. The girth, how many leaves, how long the leaves are, how many leaves grow, and how fast they grow, and so on. And we're able to correlate in our trees those which are going to be high producers later on, because we have their early growing record, which we match against productivity and are able, therefore, to judge the same. I think there's nobody else in the world who has got these data, these monthly records of over 23,000 farms. So I'm quite proud of that achievement. However, to comment about what's happening here, I don't have knowledge. I wish I could help. But one would need to study the situation here. Maybe on Friday when I come out there, I would look around and get a little more knowledge and be able to share a little bit more. But producing your own hybrid is not too difficult. I'm going to talk to Philip Young and see what he wants to do, and let's see if something can be done. But finally, what counts in agriculture is productivity. I'll give an example. In India, our government farms keep producing varieties, and every year there are at least 2, 3, 4 varieties, and now there may be 40 or 50 varieties to plant. But who wants the 40 or 50? They want only one, the one which gives them the most income for a particular need. So that's what we focused on, producing what we call a general purpose coconut, producing one for tender coconut water, and producing one for high oil levels. And we're going to have only 3 varieties, I think, forever, on these 3 bases. They're not 3 hybrids. They're not even varieties across it. So I think something similar needs to be done here. What is the market? What is required by the market? What is the productivity factor that you want to target? And then accordingly plan. Am I being a little clear?
Yes, that sounds wonderful. I'm actually curious. One of the largest problems we're facing right now in our coconut culture is a fungus called Phytophthora, and I've wondered if that's an issue in India, if you've worked on that problem, and if you've ever met a coconut that has a resistance to the Phytophthora fungus.
I'm sorry, I don't think we have that problem in India. Rather, I should say I'm happy.
Yes.
We don't have that problem, but I'm sorry I am not able to really contribute. Let me pick up some more information when I come there, so I can keep some papers ready for me. I'd look at that, and I'd give you my viewpoint, but this is what I would suggest. Look in the areas where the fungus is most rampant, and you will find one or two or more trees which have got natural resistance. If you can find those are the plants to retain for breeding.
Yes.
And we can go from there.
That's very good advice. So also for our listeners, since you grow coconuts so successfully, I wondered if you had a planting formula for the planting process and the water and fertilizer as the plants are growing up to grow highly productive coconuts.
I tend to talk too much, so I'll try and talk a little fast. I hope you don't mind me going into a little detail. The hybrid coconut, at least I'm going to talk about our hybrid coconut, its productivity is so high that you've got to be able to match management with its needs. Two main things. Starting it out, when you start it out, we tell farmers to dig a pit 3 by 3 by 3, fill it with compost, with green manure at the bottom, compost, a mixture of sand and soil, so there's aeration in the soil. And pH should be neutral, 7. And basically, that's what everybody does, I think. Now, once it gets started, don't let it overwater it. But because it's a high feeder, it does require more water. Not as a young plant, but as it matures and becomes an adult, it will we give 200 liters of water per palm per day. But that is for the dry areas in India. You have a high humidity factor here in the Hawaiian Islands because you've got sea all around you.
Yes.
But we have areas where it's very, very dry. My farm, unfortunately, the land we chose where we could afford is not the ideal place. And that's called a place town called Madurai. And there, there are only two seasons, the hot season and, as we call it, the bloody hot season. It's very dry there. And so we have to give 200 liters. If you're on the coast, as here, I would think 100 liters should be okay. But that's a little bit of trial and error. Exactly what's ideal. Higher feeding, slightly higher feeding is also required. But you have the ideal conditions of having a lot of sand. So there's a lot of, the roots are able to breathe a lot here. And I think you'd get very good results. We are finding in some places where the soil conditions are not good in India, we recommended a 4x4x4 pit, which was filled up with, as I said, the different aggregated materials. And we find that black cotton soil is where we give this advice to a farmer who has black cotton soil, which is not good. It's clayey. It tends to get waterlogged, which is not good for the coconut farm. But because he made this bigger pit, he's getting outstanding results, and he's got a few calendars, which we give calendars to our farmers with some of our best coconut trees there. And they've got huge bunches hanging on the ground when they start off at 2 years, 2.5 years of age. So so that was quite interesting. So it is the question of, I have a booklet which I'll also bring along with me, and there are technical details in there. I leave that to my technical guys. I look after only the research in my operation.
Wow, it sounds like paradise. It's been so wonderful talking with you. I have one more quick question. Do you ship your coconuts internationally?
Sorry, can we send them internationally?
The seed nuts.
Yes, we do.
You do? Very interesting.
Except that every country has its own rules and regulations, and rightly so. So we are exporting to neighboring countries who, because they're attached to India, do not have a problem. But further countries like in Africa, the protocols are being looked at between countries. It's a government-to-government thing. Thailand, Africa, Philippines, and we're looking at Brazil also. And so these processes have to take place officially, properly, and then exports will be easier. I think every country has to be careful about this because some countries have diseases which others do not have, diseases or pests which others do not have, and they must do everything not to increase the disease, the pest, the fungal problem.
Of course, of course. Well, David, it's just been such a pleasure talking with you. We're going to be moving on to a different segment of our show now called Secrets of the Soil Builders. We'll be discussing cow dung. You're welcome to stay on the line and join us if you like. We also have another guest who will be joining us.
I would like to stay on. I may not join you if there's nothing to say.
Okay, wonderful.
Good, thank you.
Well, we are happy to welcome our next guest on air. Right now we have our dear friend John Parziali of Kauai Authentic Farms. John's a permaculture homestead farmer in Mulawa'a who incorporates dairy cows in his ecological agriculture system and has some pretty strong opinions on cow manure. So, John, are you with us?
Hello.
Hey, my friend. How's it going?
How's it going?
Very well.
Nice to be with you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling in, John. It's great. You know, this is a topic close to my heart as well. So, how's the dung beetles doing over there in the pastures?
Never cease to amaze me at the recycling capacity of those little organisms. Especially I think maybe when the temperature goes up, their activity even gets a little bit more voracious even.
Wow.
Dozens and dozens of little holes drilled right into the soil and bringing the nutrients down into the soil and stuff. Good stuff.
Well, incredible. You know, I've been doing quite a bit of reading on cow dung and finding that there's a very special properties to lactating mother cows as far as what's available in their manure versus a steer manure, which is pretty much like a shot of nitrogen, but doesn't have that same balancing effect. Do you have anything you'd like to share with us about lactating mother cows?
Yeah, the numbers are surprisingly different between, you know, even, you know, beef cattle and dairy cows in terms of their manure, in terms of the nutrient content and such. I'm really happy with it. Actually, my garden's doing really well. I've been working with the dairy cows now for about 3 years on my farm, and my composting has changed over that period of time, and my fertilization scheme. I think I just did my taxes a few months ago, and I think my fertilizer inputs are down like 80%.
Wow.
In my overall project, which is in huge part to those animals, absolutely.
Yeah, so your best opportunity for collecting the manure, is that in the morning and afternoon when milking's taking place?
You know, that all depends upon your system of pasture rotation, if you have any kind of semi-confinement. If your cows are in a barn for any length of time, mine are not. The only time my cows are undercover is when they're actually being milked. And there's very typically never any manure deposits during that. So basically, my system specifically is working on, it's a managed intensive grazing, so my few cows are moving almost daily in small paddocks, which make the manure collection fairly easy.
Uh-huh. And so can you tell us a little bit how your composting system has changed from just a plant or food-based compost to including the wonderful dairy cow manure?
Well, you know, it comes back to, you know, making really sound management choices. Like, for, you know, the Gloricidia cepium tree is the classic example that comes up for me over and over, is that those trees I planted, you know, 12 years ago as a source of, you know, a nitrogen-fixing tree that I could, you know, chop the limbs and mulch with and add to compost. And now that tree has become absolutely a cornerstone, keystone species in my design, to where the branches are lopped, they're fed to the cows. The cows strip all the high protein leaves off the branches. The branches are then collected and piled and then chipped. And then my composting pretty much was basically just the raw cow manure with the Gloricidia chips and then some high nitrogen additions like coffee grounds or Gloricidia leaf. And I'm making the best compost I think I ever have, and churning it out faster than I think I ever have. So it's, yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, far out. I mean, as with everything, you are what you eat, and what's going in one end is kind of going to be coming out the other end. Yeah, so.
Which is exactly, you know, the quality of, in other words, you know, a tomato is not, you know, all tomatoes aren't created equal. And the same thing goes for a manure product. In other words, it depends on what you're feeding your cow. If you've got a confined animal that you're feeding agricultural waste to, then your manure product is going to be vastly different from, you know, an animal that's in a natural habitat, eating grass. I mean, my cows just eat grass and legumes and weeds. So what I'm getting out the other end is, I feel, a really incredible product. And it's not just for, and, you know, around the world, cow manure is used for crazy uses. I mean, burned for fuel. It's used in adobe making as a fibrous addition to mud bricks. On my farm, I've experimented with, in the composting process, there's always a few, like on the surface of the pile, which is typically covered. But the surface of the pile sometimes will have dried sort of manure clumps. And again, you know, you have to, again, take this back to, you know, you're talking about an animal that has a fermentation fat in its digestive system. So, you know, really, you know, what cow manure is fermented grass and weeds, you know. So when that completely defecates, when that totally dries out, you're left with, you know, it just basically was, you know, kind of like a permaculture observation. It's like, wow, this stuff looks just like food. And then, you know, the light bulb goes on. Say, okay, well, maybe I can stop buying, you know, soil mix. Soil is, you know, potting mix. So, yeah, last year I started using that dried out stuff. It doesn't really get composted. It just gets defecated because it's on the surface of the pile. So we'll strip those off. We break them up. You know, quite a bit of energy to break those dried pieces up. But again, by then, it's all it is really just, you know, fermented grass, dry grass, really, is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then adding some local inputs, like some cinder rock, and using it as, you know, starting my lettuce seedlings in it, you know, which is, again, just another use, you know, for the manure. Amazing.
We're speaking with John Parziali of Kauai Authentic Farms here in Molawa'a, and I believe we still have David on the line.
Yes, I'm still there.
David Lobo, coconut breeder from India, wondering, here in our part of the Western world, when we think India, cows are one of the first things that come up, the sacred cow, and wondering, especially with small farmers, is cow dung a very important fertility amendment source for the small farmer?
Yes and no. In many places, cow dung is collected and made into cow pads and used for burning because there is a shortage of fuel. But most other places, it's organized to be into gasifiers. That means we produce a methane gas which is burnt in, and effluent is a very, very good manure. It's generally used everywhere. Nothing is really wasted. You have, in fact, the very poor people going around collecting cow pads wherever they find them, fresh cow droppings, and they collect them and do various things with it.
Wow, incredible. Well, just in closing, I want to note that since most of us don't get the pleasure of having cows on our own farms, product-wise out there, there's lots of steer manure in bags and available pretty cheaply, although... most of the time, that steer manure is gathered up from factory farms, and given what those cows are fed, it's pretty questionable about whether or not we want to be adding that to our soils. I found a product at Aya's Garden recently called Booze Blend by a company called Malibu Compost. You can check them out at malibucompost.com, and they have a absolutely what I'd call sheer magic composted dairy cow manure, composted in the biodynamic way that is available here on Kauai, and I've just been having so much good luck using it that I'd like to give people that as a plan B when it comes to amending our small gardens. If we're not making our own compost, which is something we're going to be talking about in depth coming up on the show sometime soon, which is really number one, like you're doing there at your place, John. Sometimes you have to go look for a product, and this one could be a decent substitute in the meantime till we get our compost systems going.
Yeah, I really think, you know, when you talk about cow manure, when you talk about any kind of animal manure, you have to, I mean, it's just really important. And we live on an island, we really need to, we need to think about on-site fertility creation. We need to, specifically with nitrogen, you know, nitrogen is the building block. It's like, you know, all protein is made up of amino acids. Amino acids are all nitrogen-based molecules. We need to have the nitrogen cycling through our systems. And, you know, a lot of people don't quite realize that, organic farmers who are purchasing, you know, chicken manure or chicken pellets, it's like, you know, those, if you trace that nitrogen back, okay, so the bunch of kale that you're getting at the farmer's market, it's grown with, you know, the nitrogen that's really pushing that to grow is maybe coming from chicken manure, and again, that's an organic system. However, that manure is not coming from organic chickens. That very possibly is coming from a conventional, you know, chicken operation. And again, so then you ask yourself, okay, so where is the nitrogen coming from, you know, that the chickens are getting? Okay, well, it's coming from, again, a conventionally grown crop like corn. And then you ask yourself, okay, so where is the nitrogen coming? How is the corn getting that nitrogen? And it comes back to, again, synthetic nitrogen fertilizer that's created with fossil fuels and natural gas. And, so very quickly, you know, it becomes, you realize that even in the best organic systems, there's still this reliance on fossil fuel-based conventional agriculture. Basically, when you're talking about on-site soil fertility, I think animal manures that are on-site are, it's a really important thing. I think we really need to, you know, we need to explore that, and there needs to be research done how to do it in small cooperative ways, and, using a variety of different animal sources, just for sustainability's sake, anyway.
Could I add a little thought? We use cow dung with the coconut leaf itself, and feed that to worms. A special worm is there that eats coconut leaves, which most worms do not like. And we process the coconut leaves and produce our own vermicompost, which I find is better than any of the other compost, really. But we just add any cow dung that we can get. Mm-hmm. We don't have any specific. We don't have a beef cattle cow dung at all. So it's mm-hmm. just...
Well, on that subject, as well as of on-site fertility creation and cycling, we do have a Korean Natural Farming Indigenous Microorganisms workshop coming up, and it's Saturday and Sunday, July 19th and 20th, right here on Kauai. During the day, it's at Permaculture Kauai Farm in Molawa'a, and it's a two-day hands-on workshop, so this is a really in-depth learning how to make the different inputs using local and Hawaii-sourced materials. To register, there is a limited number of students who can take the course, so if you're interested in this Korean Natural Farming workshop, contact Ray Maki at 634-5412. Regular listeners will know he's also our lead representative for the Hawaii Farmers Union here on Kauai, and there is a meeting this evening from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Anahola Clubhouse of the Kauai Farmers Union. The state president, Vincent Mina, and Don Heacock will both be making presentations, and there's a 6:30 potluck with that. And again, for more information, you can contact Ray, 634-5412. We want to thank you, both so much, John Parziali and David Lobo, for joining us on the show today. Thank you. And we want to direct our listeners to David's website. That's DJ Farm, and it's spelled DeeJayFarm.com. Thank you both for being on the show today.
I wish we could talk longer.
My pleasure.
And we're looking forward to meeting you in person on Friday, David, when you come to visit for a short visit to Kauai to visit Philip Young's Dwarf Coconut Project. Very exciting
thing
we have here locally.
I look forward to that myself.
Mahalo. This has been In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts Paul and Robin. We want to invite you to tune in again next week for more stimulating conversation.